Hello, my friends, and welcome to another episode of Unlimited. Today, we are talking about resilience through unexpected career shifts. This is something that comes up for a lot of people, and interestingly enough, though, most of us don't realize how common it is. I did a podcast episode recently that was a coaching session with a woman who was going through one of these unexpected career shifts where the thing that she thought she was going to be doing wasn't really a fit for her anymore, and it was time to make a change. One of the things she was concerned about is that this was a her thing, and it's not. This is so common, especially these days in uncertain times with so much upheaval economically and everything else. I did the last episode on creating stability in times of uncertainty, and there's a reason, because there's a lot of shifting, and careers are one of those things that shifts. A tool that I will use in coaching is reflection, kind of looking back to see what your experience has been and how what you've experienced can be applied to now to create a certain amount of perspective, because it's difficult in the moment, especially when you're engaging something new, you're naturally going to feel uncomfortable, scared. There's a lot of uncertainty that goes along with it. So one way you can create stability within your own uncertainty is looking at when you've navigated something similar or something that at least had similar dynamics to it and how you showed up to it and what you can take from that. It's difficult, though, when you're in it to see that kind of reflection. So while we can look back into our past and what we can relate to, you may be familiar with the experience of being in it and feeling overwhelmed. And then later on down the line, you can look back and see it more clearly. That hindsight is 20/20 and all of that. Well, I thought it might be useful to have someone with a wealth of career experience come and talk about their journey and perhaps provide a little perspective, though, of course, everyone's journey is different. So I took this opportunity to invite someone that I have been interested in having a conversation with about this very topic of career shifts, my father, Dr. Frank John Potter, who several years ago did an Ignite talk about this very topic. Frank John Potter is a semi-retired chemist, chemical engineer, and computer support engineer. Often accused of telling you how to build a watch if you ask him what time it is, he protests that a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, so imagine what could be done with a great deal of it. Flunking out of Clarkson College of Technology led to 3 years of military service, which included a tour of Vietnam where his grasp of radar repair was put to use fixing movie projectors. Afterward, he married his college sweetheart, then attended a community college in New York where he bought his first copy of the Tao Te Ching in a bookstore. He has a Bachelor of Science Chemistry degree from Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, a Master of Science in Chemistry, and a PhD in Chemical Engineering from Vanderbilt University. During his doctoral program and while raising two daughters, John found 12-step recovery. Over his career, he has held a variety of jobs, including chemical engineer, chemist, adjunct professor, consulting engineer, video editor, technical writer, and finally worked a 15-year stint at a small company specializing in digital signage where he wore too many hats to count. At age 70, he found a passion for sharpening knives and semi-retired into entrepreneurship as the owner of Nashville Knife Sharpening. During it all, he has kept drawing, studying Taoist and other Chinese philosophy, and generally amusing himself and others with doodles and artistic witticisms. In this episode, we explore resiliency through unexpected career shifts, and some of what we talk about includes being open to the unexpected, decision-making with the support of friends, courage and defining enough, navigating unemployment, and the accumulation and use of skill sets. I'm excited to share with you a little bit of my dad, his wisdom and humor, as well as give you a small glimpse into some of my own background that has certainly had an impact on my own experience and perspective in the work that I do. So now, without further ado, let's get started. Hey there, I'm Valerie Friedlander, Certified Life Business Alignment Coach, and this is Unlimited. This podcast bridges the individual and the societal, scientific and spiritual, positive and negative, nerdy and, no, there's just a lot of nerdy. Come on board and let's unlock a life that's as badass as you are. Welcome, Dad. I'm so excited to have you on my podcast. This is unprecedented, at least on my podcast. We have not had any family. Actually, you're only the second guy I've had on my podcast. So congratulations. So I invited you on because you did a Ignite talk a few years back in the before times. And it was about punctuated equilibrium, essentially like life journey stuff. And since you did that, I was thinking, gosh, it'd be great to have you on to expound upon some of those things, because it's a very short talk. It's only like 5 minutes. And especially because I've had a number of clients recently talking about what one might call a midlife career crisis, as it were. And I thought about your Ignite talk and I thought about punctuated equilibrium. And it seemed like a really appropriate time to invite you to come share a little bit about that and what that's looked like. Because I think while everybody's journey looks differently, there's benefit in the reflective piece that we don't get until we get later on in life. Then we can look back and go, oh, and the process of living it is a little bit different. So normally I ask people to share a little bit about themselves, but because a lot of this interview is basically asking you to share about yourself, I would love to start with just asking you to share a little bit about what is punctuated equilibrium.
Punctuated equilibrium is a concept used in evolution. You have periods during which things are pretty much steady. You get small changes. Plants will start growing across a region, and then the animals will follow the plants. Certain animals will discover that they can eat this new food. At some point, a potentially cataclysmic event will occur, and that steady state of events will be totally disrupted. After the disruption, a new equilibrium is found, and things go along for a long time at that new equilibrium, and then another event will happen, and once again, things are thrown into an uproar, and when everything settles down, a new steady state equilibrium is found. So that sounds all very technical. Think of it in terms of about 65 million years ago, we had dinosaurs roaming the Earth, and then an asteroid hit the Earth. Kaboom, the sky darkened for probably a number of years from all the stuff thrown up into the atmosphere. And the dinosaurs died off and mammals took over. And this kind of event, there have been mass extinctions multiple times in the last 4.5 billion years, which is a really big number. I can't get my mind around how big it is, but I kind of get the idea. Yeah, stuff happens.
I get a lot of comments about my use of analogies and being a master of analogies. And I have to say, a lot of this is due to my dad because of his use of analogies. Would you describe how you utilized this as an analogy in your life?
So, in preparation for this talk, which I knew was going to happen, I did a little math and counted up, I think, 9 separate events in my life that would qualify as what might have seemed like a cataclysmic event at the time, but turned out not so bad. at least in retrospect. I went to college, got a degree in chemistry, and then I was a chemist for a while. And a company hired me to be an engineer, and I had to move to Massachusetts. Now, not all events are like totally destructive, like the extinction of the dinosaurs. But I moved to Massachusetts. Valerie was raised in Massachusetts, although she was born in Nashville. And I have this great job. It's sending me around the country and once to Canada to do engineering stuff. And then the company got bought and moved to Iowa, but I wasn't moved to Iowa. So I am now out of work. Now what do I do? So I found a job as a chemist again. And then that job ran into financial difficulties. And so I was let go. And I'll mention this. Just before I was let go, I found out that my wife was pregnant again with Valerie's sister, as it turns out. So I was all excited and I go in to work and I'm ready to tell people and they say, oh, by the way, we have to let you go because we can't pay you anymore. So that was a little more cataclysmic. I couldn't find a new job within an hour's drive of where we lived. My approach at that time was to put together what I call a clearness committee, a group of friends who were able to ask me questions about what do you want to do? What are you good at? What are you willing to give up to get something else kind of thing? And I ended up coming back to Tennessee at that time. I've been here ever since. And I went back to college. So a really major change. And all that took about 9 months. Went back to college, got a PhD in chemical engineering. And I had a job that used chemical engineering type stuff. And then that guy made some really bad business decisions. He was a consultant, and all his clients said, we are never hiring you again. So I was let go again. And so I looked at, gee, what have I learned how to do during this job? I learned how to do video editing as part of this chemical engineering data analysis stuff. So I had some time as my own video editor. I found a job at a local college as kind of a part-time teaching position. And I kept putting out resumes. I had printouts with me all the time. Wherever I went, I'd have one in an envelope ready to hand to anybody. You know, my father used to say that when one door closes, another door opens. He was a great philosopher, terrible cabinet maker. You can use that.
I could use that. I might just. I really appreciate that you mentioned the Clearness Committee. I'm assuming that it was a Quaker Clearness Committee.
It was, but it wouldn't have to be Quaker.
I think it's a really valuable tool that in this over-individualized society, we think, oh, I just have to figure this out on my own. And having other people, I would say, you know, either a trained professional, but also it could be a group of friends. It could be a group of people who are willing to just ask you questions and not just give their input and not tell you, well, I think you should do this, but actually ask you questions like you just described and help you discern for yourself. As we've often talked about, like people love to give advice. So having people that are intentionally coming together to support you finding what works for you, at least for now, is a really useful tool. And so I appreciate that you brought that up.
I will mention that during a clearness committee, it is often helpful to have periods of silence. 1 or 2 minutes doesn't have to be a half hour of deep meditation, especially if things are getting excited, which occasionally happens. So I think we all need to sit quietly for a moment.
That's really hard for a lot of people. It's interesting. Growing up in the Quaker tradition, which is sitting in silence for worship, sort of like meditation, it was surprising to me how many people really get uncomfortable sitting in silence and how much of a practice it is. It really is about cultivating a practice. All right. So the period that you were just talking about of when you were out of work and you were looking for work, I was probably in middle school.
You might have been going to East Magna at that time.
That would explain why you were able to drive me.
Yes.
Yeah. I actually didn't realize that you were doing video editing at that time. Because I mean, I remember that period and I remember that it was really stressful.
Let's see, I was doing video editing. I was also cutting hedges in the summer. You know, I looked at what can I do, and then I tried to monetize it, I guess. Not my favorite stuff, but necessity was the mother of invention. Then I was doing this teaching at a local college, and I applied for a full-time job teaching chemistry. And then I got a call to come to Transcender. This is one of the resumes that I had dropped off. Well, most colleges provide some kind of employment help service, and this was dropped off there. The guy who owned this company came in to the Vanderbilt, saw my resume, had me come out for an interview. I thought it was the worst interview I ever had. I wasn't prepared for the quote-unquote standard interview questions, where do you think you'll be in 5 years kind of thing. And the day that the college sent me the thank you for applying, but we're not going to hire you to be a professor, I also got the we want to offer you a job. It was synchronicity at work. So that's when I started working at Transcender as a technical editor. All through my life, I go to schooling, I learn how to do something and have a piece of paper that says I can do it, and I learn other skills. And then my next round is going to use some of those new skills, maybe almost exclusively. Like, I didn't do any chemistry at Transcender. And then Transcender was bought and moved to Atlanta. And so now I'm out of work again. I did some more video editing at that time, and I was networking with people I knew, one of whom said, oh, you need to go talk to this guy that owns this computer company. Well, while I was at Transcender, I got all these Microsoft certifications as part of my job. Transcender made test preparation software for people who wanted to pass Microsoft certification tests. So I had to go take the tests to learn what the questions were like so I could write new questions. And I ended up getting certified. So I'm out of Transcender. My friend says, go talk to this computer guy. I go talk to him. He says, well, I really don't need any help right now, but we did have a tech support person leave recently, so I could give you a try. And the kind of give you a try turned into a almost 20-year job that is what I retired from. And during the end of that job, my daughter-in-law received a very nice Japanese knife that she was afraid to use because she didn't know how to sharpen it or take care of it. And I said, oh, I'll look into that. I'll figure that out for you. And that's when I got into knife sharpening. Just as, well, let me help out Kristen and I'll sharpen her knife. And I'll sharpen my knives. Now, my grandfather tried to teach me how to sharpen knives using a carborundum whetstone, and I was never very good at it. I kept trying, but I couldn't really get knives real sharp. Well, now I'm committed to learning how to sharpen a Japanese knife, and Thank goodness for YouTube. I became YouTube knowledgeable. YouTube University can be very helpful. You have to be choosy, but there's some really good stuff out there. And I learned how to sharpen knives on Japanese whetstones. So that's what I do now. So anyway, I have this progression that I can look back and say, well, it makes total sense. But at the time, it was like, oh my God, this is catastrophic, or well, what am I going to do now? And I would look over my tool set. We all start with a tool set and we all get different tools, and some of them can turn into a career. And I found something a while ago that occasionally occurs to me. Sometimes when things seem to be falling apart, they're actually falling into place.
I reflect on, and watching you and mom go through a lot of changes and shifts in careers and following these twists and turns after events and losses and changes and all of that, that it's like, well, it's more about who do I want to be, not what do I want to be, as though my job is a definition of me. But there's a common question of what are you going to be when you grow up? I actually don't like it as a question, but I'm curious. When you were a kid, what did you want to be when you grew up?
I really honestly do not remember ever wanting to be something when I grew up as a child. And I was asked that question. I first went to college as a physics major, not because I wanted to be a physicist and study elementary particles or anything like that, but just because I was pretty good at the math. Then I got to college and found out I was terrible at calculus. That came later, but at the time, I did not do well in college. I actually made it through 3 semesters and out. The best thing I got out of going to college was that I fell in love with this lovely co-ed at a local state school, and our marriage has lasted. We both acknowledge that we are not the people we were when we got married. Relationships require their own nurturing. And sometimes you find out that this is probably not the right person, maybe a bad decision. That's okay. That was not my case, but I did learn that, that thing, I love you, you're perfect, now change. Well, change is going to happen whether or not I want it to happen, whether or not someone else wants it to happen. Okay, I mentioned that I flunked out of college. At the time, it was 1968, Vietnam War, Tet Offensive. I got my draft notice, so I enlisted in the Army. And when I got out of the Army, I went back to college, and you were asking, what do you want to be when you grow up? Well, I didn't know. So I went to a community college because they would take me. Four-year school said, your grades were so bad previously that we're not interested. So I went to a community college and I took just a spectrum of coursework: psychology, English, chemistry, calculus, painting. And I really, really liked the painting class. My house today still has some of those paintings on the wall. But I was faced at some point with the choice: do I want to be a fat chemist or a starving artist? And as much as I liked painting, I didn't think I was as good as other people that I could see. Now, granted, everything has a learning curve, but chemistry, the learning curve was short and fast for me. I could get a job as a chemist and probably do well. Now, it turned out that the chemist job that I envisioned in school never happened.
I think it's interesting to notice how So often we imagine something is going to look a particular way, but when we actually do it, it does not look at all like that. It's kind of one of the reasons why I've always disliked that question. Where do you see yourself in 5 years? Because I'm too aware of how life changes. I think having a direction can be helpful, but life is too amorphous. I've preferred, as I've frequently talked about, the term coddywomple, which is British slang for walking intentionally toward an unknown destination, because that's what I have power over, is how I move in the world. I don't necessarily know what something's going to look like once I get there.
When we explore the unknown, by definition, we don't know what we will find. I had several job interviews that I thought went really, really well. Back when I thought, well, I'm going to become a chemist and I will retire from a chemistry job with a major corporation with, you know, pension plan. And this predates 401ks and IRAs. And none of that happened. But it's been kind of a fun and interesting journey. And I learned at some point along the line to keep my gratitude up and my expectations down.
One of the things you talked about in your Ignite session was developing or finding a moral compass. And one of the things I've talked to clients even recently was about establishing a container for how you show up in the world, something to touch base on, because it's really easy to get pulled around and, oh, well, this is what I should do. My parents told me I should be this, or my college advisor suggested this, or a good friend said this, or whatever. And so I'm curious about how having a moral compass has played into your navigation of all of these punctuated equilibrium experiences.
As far as moral compass, I love the compass analogy, because if you have a real compass, magnetic compass, and you bring a magnet near the compass will suddenly shift over to point at the magnet, and take the magnet away and the compass goes back to magnetic north. If you're looking for work and somebody offers you a whole bunch of money, even if the job is not very attractive, your compass can suddenly point toward the money. Having a certain amount of money for a job is important, but I wouldn't take some jobs just because I'd be uncomfortable with the work. I would make a terrible telemarketer because I don't like calling people up and telling them what they need to do, even though in my heart, I know it's probably not the best thing for them.
I think it's helpful as a reflection. Money in the way that we live in the world right now, in our society currently, in our economy currently, we need to make money. And so it's very understandable that that would be pulled, like, I need to make a living. I need to support my family. I need to do those things. And so having that awareness of, and I just talked about this recently, it's a factor. Money is a factor. We can't like discount it, because when we go, oh, it's not a factor, that compass gets pulled towards the magnet and we're like, no, that's not what's happening. But it is. And when we can recognize what has that attractiveness, what has that sway on us, then we can acknowledge it and engage it with intention rather than just being like, that's not what's happening. And or pull ourselves in the completely opposite direction in a way that is actually counter to what our needs are, because we're discounting them and we're not acknowledging them.
One way of finding a moral compass is to find some religion, or in my case, philosophy that fits. The Tao Te Ching has a statement, "He who knows he has enough is rich." In other words, if you have enough, and you know it, then you have enough.
Yeah. That's one of the things I often been looking at, is defining enough. Because we're fed this idea that we don't have enough constantly. There's this just general sense. And sometimes we don't. Sometimes we don't have enough. But if you don't know what enough is, you won't know when you have it. and you will have a harder time figuring out how to get it. So when you know what that looks like, then you can make more clear choices. And I think about like just the odd jobs, like what you say yes to for work, you know, may very well have to do with like, well, what is enough? And is this the place that I can get it from? And it's not just enough money, but it's enough fulfillment. It's enough support. It's enough flexibility. It's enough, you know, like what does that actually look like if you can define it? One thing that I wanted to ask you about in doing this Ignite session, which I will have a link to in the show notes. You know, it took a lot of courage to do that talk, and it was way outside of your comfort zone. And a lot of times people want to do things, but they're scared and they know they need to implement courage. You didn't have to do the talk, and yet you did anyway. And I'm curious what motivated you and what helped you actually show up to that.
All right. A good part of it was I was asked. I did not think, gee, I'd really like to do a talk. I wonder where I could do it. No, my daughter-in-law was working for the organization at the time. And her boss went to her and said, we need someone who's done like a major career change, maybe after retirement. Do you know anybody like that? So part of it was to support her, but I was told, gee, John, you don't have to do this. But it gave me an opportunity to step outside of my comfort zone. Now, I am not a person who deliberately steps out of his comfort zone just to do that. I don't ever plan to go bungee jumping. I hope I never have to jump out of an airplane, a perfectly safe airplane with a parachute on my back. But I was able to be of support. I was hoping, you know, who knows, maybe it'll get her a promotion. It didn't, but I didn't know that. And it gave me a chance to talk about myself. Not that I want to get up on podia and talk about myself all the time, but and it was a bit of a challenge, a personal challenge. You get 5 minutes, you get 20 slides, you get 15 seconds per slide, and the slide is going to change whether or not you're ready. If anybody wants to find that talk, it is on YouTube.
Oh, I plan on linking it in the show notes.
I got mine because I edited it because I can video it.
Because you can do that.
Because I can do it. And at the end of it, I have an outtake. The presentation was done twice. There was a morning and an afternoon repeat. In the morning, I forgot my lines. It was described as you're doing a tango with your slides, and the slides will keep dancing even if you fall down. So in the morning session, I fell down. And I had a pretty good recovery, I guess. And then during lunch, I worked really hard on what did I forget? Where did I screw up? And the afternoon one is the one that's in the video, and it came off pretty good, I think.
One of the last things that I ask people on this podcast when I do an interview is, what does it mean to you to be unlimited? So I would love for you to answer that question.
Yeah, I saw where you asked that. Well, maybe it's like Buzz Lightyear to infinity and beyond. I think for me, it's been more, and this goes back into my childhood where it didn't work to my benefit, that I was more aware of my limitations. What does it mean to be unlimited? I'm not sure I can agree with that question.
Well, I've had people kind of reframe it of like, I don't think I am, and I don't think we should be. And I think this about that idea of unlimitedness, I mean, The podcast is called Unlimited mostly because of how much we allow other people to limit us. Because I think we do need to be limited. We need to create a container for ourselves, but we need to recognize, you know, mom would always say, the realm of all possibilities. And that's kind of overwhelming. And it never really worked for me. But I think it's helpful to know that there is a realm of all possibilities. I'm just choosing to create my own space in that, not just to be like bleh, everywhere, all the things.
You know, if you're in the middle of the ocean, all you see is water all around you and it looks totally unlimited forever. But if you start swimming, eventually you come to land. I'm more focused on what have I allowed myself to be limited by? And I don't have the ability to run anymore. I used to love to jog. Jogging was my passion because it's an individual activity. I am not competing against anyone except myself. And even there, I'm not really competing because some days I know I'm going to be able to go longer, faster than other days. But I can't run anymore because I broke a bone in my foot. And if I walk, no problem. If I run where that break happened, my foot starts saying, you don't want to do this. Did you hear me? You don't want to do this. So to be unlimited is to be aware of what limitations I have, which ones are permanent, which ones will change over time, and which ones have I imposed on myself. So to be unlimited is, for me, being aware of my limitations. I'm almost 75 years old. There are things that I can't do anymore, but I have ways around them. Or, I mean, I don't have diabetes, but a diabetic is not likely to go, ooh, birthday cake, give me 2 pieces. They have limitations. Sometimes those limitations are because of past choices. Sometimes they're genetic. I mean, they could be religious. If you're an Orthodox Jew, you probably won't eat bacon no matter how good it smells when it's cooking. It's a limit.
Yeah.
Deliberate. Intentional. Are my limits intentional?
Mm-hmm. And when you want to feel that unlimited feeling, that expansive feeling, if you will, what song would you choose to listen to?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Purple Haze by Jimi Hendrix.
Awesome. I will add that to the Spotify playlist.
Also, Pink Floyd, The Wall, the whole album, though, you got to listen to.
I'm not going to put the whole album on the playlist.
No.
So that's an interesting choice. What about that makes you feel unlimited?
Well, my older daughter and I used to spend a lot of time in the car together, going to voice lessons and getting driven to school and picked up. And I had that on a cassette tape. This goes back a few years. And if the two of us were alone in the car together, that cassette tape was popped in, and wherever it had stopped playing, it would start playing again and again and again and again and again. And
so it was played unlimitedly.
It was played unlimited times over a number of years.
Yep.
And that is one of my favorite driving music. Not with my wife. It's not her music, but it's our music. She likes it, but she wouldn't want to listen to it over and over and over. Whereas my older daughter and I could. I'm sure you and I could too.
Yeah, probably, given that we're one and the same person.
Well, at the time.
I mean, it's true. Well, thank you, Dad, for joining me for this conversation. I've really enjoyed it.
Well, good.
And I look forward to sharing it.
Very good.
Thanks for listening. I so appreciate you being here. If you got something out of today's episode, please share it. Leave me a review, take a screenshot, and post it on social with a shout out to me. send it to a friend, or, you know, all of the above. Want to hang out more? Join me on Instagram. Or better yet, get on my mailing list to make sure you don't miss out on anything. And remember, your possibilities are as unlimited as you are. Allow yourself to shine, my friend. The world needs your light. See you next time.